choke me out.
When the housing crisis came about, every morning on the drive to work, I'm listening to NPR, and more people in foreclosure, more and more people underwater on their homes, all of the myriad problems that we saw when the really big housing crisis hit, and kind of thinking at the same time of all of these different alternative methods that we had seen people doing, people that we sort of profiled. I knew more about their groups outside of what had been in the magazine, and was kind of thinking, like, there's all these alternative methods for creating housing for people that struck me as really important to be discussing during this time when the housing market had sort of been falsely inflated because of investments to the point that people were losing their homes. And that's exactly what I wanted to start investigating. Could we look at lower cost homes? How much lower cost? And the answer that I sort of discovered as I started interviewing people for my books were incredibly lower cost. The people in my book, every single one of them did this without a mortgage. Some of the organizations have small mortgages that they help people get, but we're talking virtually no money put into financing the actual building of these homes, and yet people have beautiful homes that they love to live in. So I wanted to just sort of present that to people and say, maybe there's an alternative method of obtaining this American dream of owning your own home outside of the conventional market, which was at the time very scary for a lot of people to be wanting to jump into.
So no mortgage, very low cost. How were all of the people that you came into contact with able to do this?
Most of the people who are individuals who are featured in the book, or all of them really, used salvaged materials. So they were spending virtually nothing on materials. Getting land is always going to cost money. There's just no way of getting around that. And so some of them had already purchased land. One of the families had land that they had been given by a grandparent who had passed away. And so that is an issue to overcome. And then several of the groups have come up with more formalized methods of helping low-income people get the tracts of land that they need to build their homes. But beyond that, they're using free materials and then putting tons and tons of their own effort into it. Dan Phillips of the Phoenix Commotion is one of the most inspirational people to me that I featured in the book. The Phoenix Commotion is based in Huntsville, Texas, and it's a group that builds low-income housing for people out of almost exclusively salvaged materials. And he has a lot of interesting things to say about the level of difficulty that we attribute to building houses and how it's really not rocket science. Most of the things that are required to build a house are fairly basic. And up until really not that long ago, most people did build their own homes. So to automatically assume that there's some sort of level of complexity with building a house that none of us can ever attain to do this is pretty much a false notion. Yes, for some very specific aspects you would want to subcontract, like electricity and things like that, but these people were saving money as they went along, and they were putting tons of time into it, and they were putting a lot of time and effort into gathering materials, but they were not putting a ton of money into it. One of them talked about putting in the resources that you have. And he said, well, we didn't have money, but we did have time and energy and enthusiasm. So we put in those resources rather than a resource we didn't have, money.
So how are they learning the process of building their houses? Did they have like a guide somewhere along the way? Were they looking at YouTube videos? What was their process?
A couple of them were builders who were already experienced in it. The other method, the one couple was not experienced whatsoever, and they did a straw bale home. And so what they did was started working with the Straw Bale Association in their town. Most cities have a straw bale association if you go online and look for one. And they will often do workshops. So you go and help on somebody else's house and you kind of learn the ropes. And then you basically host your own workshop when it's time to do your house. So you get a bunch of people to come and help you after you've gone out and sort of learned the basics of what you need to do. So that's one method that people use to learn. Another one in the Phoenix Commotion, for example, Dan Phillips, who runs that organization, he takes applicants and then he makes sure that every single homeowner that he creates a house for is participating in the building of their own home. And so he is there kind of acting as a mentor and helping them. So he also recommends, yes, going and doing like builder's workshops. There's sometimes classes that you can take at home stores. You can look things up online. You can take seminars. There's a lot of ways that if you're really wanting to do this, that you can learn that information. There's tons of resources available to you. It's just a matter of accessing them and taking the time to actually do these workshops, do these seminars, learn this information for yourself.
So using reclaimed materials and their own labor and their friends' labor drastically cut down the cost of a house. How much money does one of these houses that they're building themselves and using reclaimed materials actually cost?
I don't think that I have a straight figure on how much they spent, but like I said, there was no financing. So they're using money as they went along, you know, that they sort of could set aside. I would estimate less than a few thousand dollars to build all of these houses. You know, straw, depending on what area of the country you live in, straw bales you can acquire for very inexpensively. Now, contracting someone to build you a straw bale house is very expensive, but the actual materials that go into it are very low cost. And then in a straw bale structure, if you're not familiar with it, you use straw bales as the interior of the wall, and then you cover them with a plaster, and you can make the plaster yourself. We've run recipes for making homemade plaster in Natural Home and Garden. You can look one up. It's essentially a mix of mud and sand and usually something like straw to give it some texture, and you slather that on the walls. And so the materials that we're talking about are incredibly inexpensive. Now, moving on to salvage materials, it's unbelievable to me the amount of high-quality salvage materials that these people were able to gather. Some of them were going to salvage yards and hunting through things. Most of them were from deconstruction. In most neighborhoods, most towns, if you go around, you'll see a very good portion of houses that are being deconstructed. I think that we're sending something like 135 million tons of deconstruction waste to the landfill every year. It's one of the largest components of landfill waste.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, how many houses would that amount to?
I'm trying to remember how many millions. We're demolishing a huge portion of the amount of houses that we actually need. So these people were going to the various deconstruction people. The one couple, they lived in Idaho, and they would go to the town and kind of get to know the people who did the deconstruction, and they would call them ahead of time because they don't like the idea of tearing down all this perfectly good windows and things and just sending them straight to the landfill and say, hey, do you want to come cherry pick stuff out of this house? And so they would go and get huge amounts of building supplies out of these houses before they were demolished.
That sounds incredible. So they just buy out the pieces as they're being deconstructed. So they say, like, I'll give you, like, $30 for this window and $20 for this.
They weren't buying them. They're getting them for free.
For free? Wow.
Yeah, they're not buying them. They're going. These are things that are going to the landfill anyway. And, yeah, if you read the story, then one of the other families that lived in Alabama, they built their home out of almost entirely reclaimed materials, as did everyone in the book. But they got the majority of them also from the neighborhood, the town. He has this joke that he collected things from every town in his county. But it was buildings that were being torn down for whatever reason, or old barns, things like that. He would go and say, hey, are you tearing this down? Can I take all of the wood before you do? And they'd say, yeah, haul it away and it's yours. And so he would. And he just sort of gathered all these things over time and to the point that he had enough to actually create an entire house out of it. And then the same thing, as I said, with the couple in Idaho, they really just sort of developed relationships with the builders and deconstruction people in their area so that they were getting heads up, hey, there's a big house that we're going to be tearing down. Everything is going to the landfill. If you want to come and take whatever you can, go for it on, you know, such and such day.
Why are all these houses getting torn down all the time? Is it just that some of them are old, or they're getting bought out by a developer and it's being redeveloped? Or why is there so much landfill waste?
A variety of reasons. It could be that they're very old. It could be that someone doesn't want to put the money into fixing up an old house, so they come through and tear it down and put up a tract of houses that are more modern seeming. I know in the couple in Idaho's case, they live near Jackson, Wyoming, which is a fairly wealthy vacation spot. And so they said, oh, well, people, they're looking to make their dream vacation home. And so they would come and buy a piece of land, and they didn't care how much they were spending. They wanted to just knock down whatever was there and build their dream home. So that there were a 10,000 square foot home in Jackson is where they got a huge quantity of the stuff that's in their house. And they just basically got the heads up that this not very old house was going to be torn apart, come and get the stuff. And when I talked to them, it was about 5 years after they had sort of started this project that Aaron Power said, we're still getting phone calls because they're like, oh my gosh, we're tearing down this house and there's these really great cabinets. We don't want to trash them, but I mean, do you want them? Do you know anyone that wants them? I mean, there's a human instinct to not want to throw away perfectly good things.
Where are these families living in while they're constructing these homes?
Well, the couple that I talked about in Idaho were living in, they had a bunch of their family members come out over the course of the summer that they were building the house. The couple, both of their younger sisters came and stayed with them, and then one of their fathers came, and they had a trailer I think they said they had a teepee that someone brought and set up for them, and they had, like, tents, and they had set up sort of a little bathroom set up, and they said it was just sort of this weird campsite that they were staying in over the course of the summer while they were doing this. They all said it was really, really fun, even though it may kind of sound awful. They said they got sort of a system down, and it was sort of a party atmosphere, and they all were camping out and having a great time. The couple who, the people who moved into the house in Alabama, they were living in a different home that I believe they sold afterwards. He is a builder, and so they had actually, through the course of their whole lives, been sort of living in one home while fixing up a home and then moving into the next home and fixing that up and continuously sort of working on places. It's, that family is really a fantastic story. The three sons were teenagers when they were building the house, and they will really tell you how connected they are with this home, and they kind of talk about how, well, we never felt really connected to our homes growing up because we moved around so much. You know, our family didn't have tons of money, and this was our dad's job, and so we were constantly moving around, and they're like, even though when we were 16 years old, the last thing we wanted to be doing on the weekend was spending it the entire time working on this house, it's now like one of the most powerful memories to us and shaped us as adults, and two of them went into building, and one wants to be an architect. And it really made a huge impact on their life, way more than your standard sort of suburban home that you move into and is kind of this white box that you put your stuff on the wall. It's completely customized. Every part of their home has this family memory for them.
Yeah, and you've got a huge bond to your house if you're building it from scratch. So you mentioned that they're working on the weekends. Do they, these people have 9-to-5 jobs that they're working during the week? Is that
yeah,
how they're
everybody was employed. Themselves? Mm-hmm. Everyone was fully employed during the time that they built their houses.
Wow. So they're able to just devote their weekends straight to the house building.
Yeah, and evenings, they said. The thing with house building is kind of there's little things to do and then there's big things. So you have your big, like if you're doing a straw bale house, a couple in Idaho did straw bale, as did the one in Colorado. You have your big work party weekend where you go and you pretty much like you've erected all the walls and you've done all of your sort of pre-wall building in one weekend. And then you have a weekend where you plaster all the walls and you have 20 people come and they help you and you plaster the walls and you get that all done in one weekend. And then you have other weekends where you're doing smaller things. But, you know, so I think there's kind of an ebb and flow of the workload.
Well, it seems to me that the prices of houses just being astronomical these days, people are going to be putting down $300,000 for like a large family home. Why is it that most people are not building their own homes? Making the leap from purchasing a home to building one seems kind of like a common sense thing to do if you don't have the cash to lay down to buy a home. Mm-hmm. Is there a stigma against building a home? Is it because people are not been brought up to build their own homes? Why is it that people are not building their homes more?
I think because there's sort of a cultural attitude that you go out and you buy a home, that we don't possess the skills to build our own homes, that building homes is far too complex for the average person to do. Even managing the building of a home, I think a lot of people think is too complicated. And like I was saying before, one of the biggest things that Dan Phillips is always talking about from Phoenix Commotion is building a home isn't rocket science. People have been doing this for years. Up until 100 years ago, it was not uncommon for many, many people to build their own homes the world over in a billion different styles. So to completely discount the notion of being able to do it because it's simply too complex and too difficult, I think is sort of culturally ingrained and something that I don't know if there's a reason that the market wants people to believe this or if it's just sort of become in our industrialized nation, it's easier to buy a house. It's easier to go out and buy marinara instead of growing your own tomatoes like we used to do and making it yourself. There's just more of a sort of, this is made by people who specialize in this area, not everyone doing it for themselves. And although that's maybe fine for a lot of people, I think considering the idea, opening our minds to the idea that maybe we could build a home ourselves is a kind of exciting and fun way to think about things and also potentially a way that people can achieve this dream if they don't have the financial resources to do it.
So I'm thinking about all of the people who really suffered when the bubble was first bursting, when the housing crisis really started back in 2005, 2006, and then it was picking up steam. And I just remember seeing images of whole communities in California just completely being emptied out. So let's say you were underwater on your mortgage and were thinking about where to go. A lot of people maybe moved back to their hometowns or moved in with family members. Do you think it's possible that if someone is foreclosed on or really experiencing a lot of pressure because their house is now worth less than what they paid for it, that going out and building a home is really an option?
Yeah, I think that that would be a great option. Obviously, you have to resolve the situation with the original house, but in that situation, it's very likely that your credit has been damaged too. So the idea of going out and getting a loan is probably not very feasible. And I think instead of saying, okay, well, I have no options open to me, that's sort of why I wanted to write this book and why I wanted to present other models. It's interesting because you sort of talk about this and it's like, oh, well, this could never work. And it's like, to me, I'm thinking, but here are the people who have done it. They're living in these houses. They have already done this and are talking about how they did it. So it's not like this is a theory that hasn't been tested. People are actually doing this. It's just very, very outside our normal sort of set of ideas about how one goes about making a home.
Do you really see this as a model in moving forward in rethinking housing in the United States? And how would the United States really start about rethinking its model of housing and home ownership?
One half of my book are individuals who built their own houses using reclaimed materials. The other half of my book are organizations that are doing this, that are creating low-income housing out of salvage materials, because I think for an individual to go out and build their own home out of salvage materials is great. It is awesome, and I think it's totally a possibility that that people should consider. But is everyone in America going to go out and build their own home out of salvage materials? No, that's not systemic kind of change that we're going to see. However, could we alter the fact that we demolish more than 250,000 homes every year in the United States? We send 135 million tons of construction debris to landfills every year, and over half of that is demolition waste, about 40% from renovation and remodeling. So it's huge numbers of
homes. Wow, a quarter of a million homes.
Yeah.
Wow.
That we are demolishing. And when I say demolishing, we're not going in and taking out the windows and saying, oh, could we reuse these windows? Could we reuse these cabinets? No, it's a bulldozer comes and bulldozes every single thing that's in that house, and it goes straight to the landfill with not even what they call cherry picking, which is going in and sort of just pulling the immediately obvious reusable things. The organizations that are doing this, I think, do provide a model for how we could consider actually using this on a nationwide basis. There's also a fantastic group that anyone interested in this should look up. They're called the Building Materials Reuse Association. The website is bmra.org, and they are a group that is dedicated to advancing the idea of deconstruction over demolition. So I could see, and I know they can definitely see and are encouraging, a national system where instead of demolishing, we go into these homes and deconstruct them, inventory the items, have some kind of system where we're then reusing these materials or making these materials available for very cheap to people who do want to use them. But the organizations, there's one in Texas, the Phoenix Commotion, as I've mentioned many times, they take applications. People come and say, I'm a low-income person, I need a house, and then if they're selected, then they build a home for them. They give them seed money, essentially. Dan has set up a seed money fund. So let's say I need $5,000 in supplies to get going on the house. The seed money fund gives them that money. They go out, they buy the supplies, whatever they need. He says, you know, new wiring you should buy, new plumbing, and everything else he's getting is reclaimed. They give them the money, then they build the house. Obviously, the house, once it's built, is worth much more than the $5,000. And so they can take out a very small mortgage worth even, you know, less than the actual cost of the house to repay that seed fund. And then they're living in a house with a mortgage of $10,000, let's say, for example.
So the family takes out the mortgage or the Phoenix?
The family. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
The family.
Yeah, and then you're living in a house that didn't contribute to landfills, all the toxic materials that are inside of a house as well, right?
Absolutely. Another group that I talk about is Builders of Hope. They are based out of North Carolina, actually. I don't know if you've heard of them, Seth. They're in Raleigh and several other North Carolina towns. They've also expanded recently, I believe, to Texas and a few other cities. And they take whole homes that were going to be demolished. And rather than demolishing them, the family who, let's say, has bought this plot donates it. And then they get generally land granted to them by the city because they've done such amazing work and like establishing whole healthy neighborhoods. So they'll get land and they take these would-be demolished homes, move them to a new area, remodel them, and then put low-income homeowners in them.
What is it that everyone looks for when they're trying to find these salvaged materials? Is it just mainly that they're going to landfills pulling this out, or is there actually like salvage places other than just going into deconstructed homes?
It depends on what the laws are in your state. Some states have laws against salvaging anything from landfills. Some have specific types of landfills where you are able to salvage and others where you aren't. There are more formalized salvage places, definitely. In big cities, there's salvage places, and they're kind of expensive, like antique stores. But then you can also find sort of lower end, I guess would be how I describe it, salvage yards that have salvage stuff that's not only the most high quality, amazing architectural details, but just more masses of salvage. You also can, as I said, get in with deconstruction crews, demolition crews, builders in your area, for example, may be good to talk to. People in the book talk about going to old barns in the country that are falling down and asking the owner, can I take this wood off of your hands? And they'll say yes. Another good resource, the Building Materials Reuse Association that I mentioned at bmra.org has a huge directory of reclaimed building material sources on its website. It's searchable by state. I included tons of them in my book also. And then Dan Phillips, he has a really interesting method where most of the stuff that he is getting isn't actually salvage in terms of coming out of other buildings. It's things like mildly damaged goods. So he's like, I will go to, say, a lumber manufacturer and say, hey, if you have anything that's damaged that you can't use, let me know. And he's like, I've had 3 18-wheeler trucks full of redwood, hardwood show up. He has a big storage warehouse, and it's because it was maybe slightly water damaged or something like that. So it can't be sold. There's nowhere else for it to go because it's somewhat damaged other than the landfill. And you have to actually pay a fee to send it to the landfill. So he's like, once I started getting my name out there and saying, I want your slightly damaged building materials or whatever, things just start showing up because it's free for them to donate it. They can write it off as a donation, and they're not paying a landfill fee. And so he's like getting tons of stuff. He said he has people calling them up. One of his really amazing prizes is the entire ceiling is made up of the frame corners. If you go to a frame store, you know, on the wall, they'll have all those sample frame corners hanging.
Yeah.
And yeah. At the end of the season, what do they do with those? They throw them all away. And so he's like, I go to the store and say, hey, when you're done with all these, I'll take them. And he's like, they will give me, you know, trash bags full of them. And then he uses them as a ceiling. You need to go to the Phoenix Commotion website and see the photos of the things that he makes. But it's all out of things you would never imagine using. He has a whole wall of windows, and they're all these circular windows that sort of let the light filter in. And they're all old pickle, like relish serving trays that are glass.
Wow.
Somewhere. So the university calls him up and says, I have 10,000 DVDs I'm going to throw away. Do you want them? And he's like, sure. I have no idea how I'm going to use these 10,000 DVDs, but I'll figure it out.
Wow. So he gets all these materials and then figures out how to fit them into his next building project?
Yeah. Yep.
It's pretty incredible. That's kind of like when the bakery, at the end of the day, when they finish with all their bread, they just put it in a bag outside the back and they just give it away.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about tumbleweed houses. Have you ever heard of those before?
Tumbleweed? Oh, yeah.
Tumbleweed.
We've featured Jay Schaefer many, many times over the years in Natural Home. I'm very familiar with him.
So the small housing movement is kind of redefining the way that people think about houses. And I've been really interested in building one and buying the plans and just kind of trying it out. And these houses are really unique for our listeners who haven't heard of them because a lot of them are less than 400 square feet. Do you see any sort of trend with these smaller size houses for people in the United States or in the world?
Absolutely. We actually have a section in Natural Home and Garden almost every issue we call tiny houses because we've noticed so many people, whether they really even are going to move into a tiny house or not, are fascinated by them. And I think people love the idea of living in a more manageable space. Housing size in the United States has gone down. In 2010 was the first year in the past 50 years that it had actually gone down. And I do think people are very interested in a more moderate-sized home, whether it be a super tiny home that I think is really great for some people and that people are really fascinated by, or a home that's more in the 1,000 to 1,200 square foot range where it's not super duper tiny, but it's manageable and it's not huge. People don't want to pay massive energy bills. People don't want to have to spend hours and hours cleaning and doing maintenance and all of that. They want to live somewhere that's comfortable, that's designed well, that has space-saving properties. And all the people in my book also did talk about having a smaller home as a major way that helped them be able to complete this project. You're not going to build a 3,000 square foot house out of salvaged materials. Like, it's just unmanageable, I would think. So they all did focus on having a restrained space. And the Powers House in Idaho has some really amazing space-saving things that they did because that was one of their main goals. Their dining room table is sunken beneath the floor of their living room. So they have a little countertop space where they can eat day to day, but they have a section of wood in their floor, and they pull it away, and it has a sunken bench-style, like, formal dining room table in the floor. And then when they're not using it, they just put that plank of wood back on in its regular floor. They also have a sunken Japanese-style soaking tub that is under the floor of their shower. So they shower normally, and then if they want to sit in the soaking tub, pull away the shower floor, and there's a sunken tub underneath. So then they did a bunch of other space-saving things. So I absolutely think that living in smaller, more reasonable-sized houses is a huge trend, and I expect it to continue because, like I said, people want something that's manageable. They're living a comfortable life. They have enough storage space, but not these unused rooms that you're paying to heat, you're paying to clean, you're paying to cool. For what? To use it once every 6 months. I think people are just over that.
Is all of this housing waste an American problem? We were just talking about smaller spaces, and a lot of the rest of the world is more accustomed to living in smaller spaces. Is all the housing waste and all the materials that are going to the landfill really a United States issue, or are other countries throwing away materials and have that reclaimed material that they could draw on as well?
No, I really don't know. I mean, I would imagine that it is similar. I would also think that possibly in like Europe and Japan and things, there are better systems for reclaiming. There may also in cultures that have older architecture be more of a sort of motivation to save older architecture. But I really don't know. Most of my research focused on the United States.
So we've had a guest on the show who talked about how China is building up all of these cities, very, very modern-looking cities with buildings and lots of modern-looking houses in them, to be used as storage, as a way to sequester materials and resources in a way that's easily maintained and not able to be taken by other projects. So we've had guests talk about how these model cities are going to be used to be deconstructed later on when we hit hard times and use those materials in other ways. Have you heard about this?
No, I don't think I have heard about this.
I wanted to ask about the energy and ecological performance of these houses. I mean, obviously you're using reused materials, so that's going to bring down the overall ecological footprint of the whole home building process. But once they're built, you know, energy efficiency compared to like a suburban tract home or something, are they really all that much better?
Of course, energy efficiency and all of that depends on your location, but for example, the straw bale houses that are in the two colder climates, Colorado and Idaho, are incredibly efficient, and they perform very, very well from an ecological point of view. They are highly insulated. They are very healthy as well because the walls can breathe, which is another issue with walls that are made out of conventional drywall and the bad material, fiberglass insulation. It's not incredibly healthy for you to be breathing in and out every day versus these are made of natural materials that breathe. And so straw bales incredibly great. I think in Alabama, they, like, for example, he restored all of the original windows and they're single pane glass. Well, they live in a really warm climate. I do not believe they have air conditioning. I think that he just sort of built it with breezes in mind. There's a lot of methods that you can use to try to naturally cool your house, to naturally keep heat in. But the key thing is for heating, you're in Canada, for example, and want to stay warm, to have good insulation. And so that's another component that you're going to need to think about. Straw bale, as I said, very highly insulative. I don't know if it's perfect for incredibly damp conditions. I don't think you can not use it in the Pacific Northwest, because I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of straw bale associations, but you may need to take some extra cautions. And like I said, building shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all kind of thing, and that's another part of these sort of suburban tract homes that are thrown up. They are using the same materials. They're not considering their site in terms of how you position the house. They're not using sort of the wisdom that we've had for years of how to naturally cool, how to use breezes, how to use shading. And they're tossed up. It's a one-size-fits-all proposition. You move in, you put your stuff on the walls, and there you go. There you have it. That's not how you should be building a house if you're trying to build a home that you want to live in. You should consider your site. You should consider your climate. You should be wondering what materials are best for this area to help me reduce my costs and things like that. So yeah, definitely something people have taken into account as they've been doing this, and something I definitely would encourage anyone to take into account.
What kind of home do you live in?
Well, I actually just moved into a house that was remodeled with tons of sustainability in mind. I was very, very, very fortunate to find a house like this. It was a 1950s house. The former owner had completely remodeled it. It has poured concrete floors. It has in-floor radiant heat. We have a wood-burning stove, which is a really efficient method of heating your house. It was built for passive solar. It has 15 skylights, 13 of which are operable to help with breezes, and it was built so that it could have natural ventilation. There's a built-in sunroom that was designed for passive solar to help keep things warm and so we can grow things like lettuce inside over the winter. And I was renting before. I was actually, you know, we'd been talking about my book that I'd worked on at the time and maybe building a house like this, and then we came across the luckiest, most amazing house that was designed by someone who really took all these things into consideration. And so I moved in there last summer. And we actually were featured recently in the Kansas City newspaper, and it's inkkc.com. If you search me there, you can actually take a little tour of my house.
So right now, in these tumultuous economic times, a lot of people have been holding off on buying a house. Do you have an argument for buying versus renting? Is there one way or another you feel strongly about?
I mean, I think that the conventional wisdom that by buying you're investing in something is still true, although I would also say that outside of buying a really amazing house, I too had definite hesitations getting into the housing market because I saw how it had been manipulated and how it had led to a lot of people losing a lot of money. And so I understand that there's some hesitation to get into it. I also don't know that owning a house, I think it's a great thing. I think it gives you a sense of sort of permanence. Some people really desire the dream to own a house. And if that's the case, I think definitely you should go for it and not take a scary housing market as a reason not to. If anything, like I said, part of the reason I wrote this book was to give people the sort of inspiration to think, hey, maybe I could actually own a house and I don't have to participate in this system. So if you want to go that route and you want to put the work into it, maybe you can own a house without having to participate in the somewhat frightening investment home market that we have right now. I also don't think renting is a bad thing necessarily. I don't think that you pay a certain portion of your income to live somewhere. It's just you are kind of at the mercy of others in terms of how much you're going to be paying.
So we had just a few more questions for you. I wanted to ask about squatting because in a lot of other countries, the laws are structured so that squatting is quite a bit easier. I was talking to someone recently who was in Switzerland, and as long as you stayed in this one place in this one town in Switzerland, I can't remember the name of it, after like a month, the city would come in and hook up phone and water for you. And I wanted to know if you'd thought at all about squatting or had looked into it at all when you were writing this book.
I would definitely not say that I have a lot of information on the subject whatsoever. I have read a few things in the course of my work at the magazine kind of talking about that we need to be more inclusive of people who just are never going to be able to afford conventional housing and deal with these people rather than sort of pushing them to the margins of society. Lester Brown talks about that some in some of his books, and I'm always amazed when I read his work of how smart and prescient he is. But I wouldn't consider myself a great expert in that topic by any means.
What is your vision for housing of the future? What do you think it would look like in your ideal world?
Well, I would love to be removed from people being able to far away make investments that affect the price of housing. I don't know if that will ever happen. We only have allowed speculative investment in housing since, I think, the late 70s. So it's a fairly new thing, and I think that we should do away with it. That is what got us into this huge mess, was that people were investing in houses and buying the bundled mortgages, and it was causing low-interest mortgages to be given out to people who were not necessarily qualified for them because it was sold right on up the ladder to high-level investments. So I think that we need to fix that. I think that it would be wonderful if we could create a national system of deconstruction, the reutilization of all of the high-quality building materials that we have that we're right now throwing away for absolutely no reason. And I think it would be great if overall housing prices stabilized or even went down. I do know that that causes some economic problems. But to me, in terms of is it more feasible for long term that we all can have affordable housing, or is it more feasible for the long term that housing prices continue to go up so that people at the top can make more money? I would prefer to see housing prices level off or go down, and we deal with the economic consequences of that so that people can afford to have a place to live. So those are these three components in my mind. No speculative investments into bundled mortgages, a national system of deconstruction, and the leveling or even lowering of housing prices in terms of percentage of overall income that we're expected to spend to have a place to live.
Excellent.
Really noble.
Was there anything that we missed that we should have covered?
I don't think so. I feel like I've talked your ear off for long enough. So.
Just looked at your house also, and it's really, really beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I absolutely love it. Like, they didn't even put it on the market. It was kind of a word of mouth type of thing, and we lucked into being the people that really melded well with the people that were selling the house and loved it and were able to move in. So it was really lucky.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Jessica.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Have a good night. All right. Bye.
You too. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And that takes us into all of the great links and news items that our listeners send in to us, that post on our Facebook page. And I just wanted to highlight one that Robin sent in recently, which was actually one of the blog posts from John Michael Greer's Arch Druid Report. And on the Arch Druid Report, John Michael Greer's highlighting an idea of seven sustainable technologies. And so for most people, that's ideas of wind turbines and solar photovoltaic panels or the smart grid. But John Michael Greer is saying that organic intensive gardening, solar thermal technologies, sustainable wood heating, sustainable healthcare, basically practicing healthcare as it was done 100 plus years ago, and also using some of the ideas that our modern research has discovered, letterpress printing, shortwave radio, computer-free mathematics. These are the things that over the next few hundred years will be extremely valuable and useful. And since you don't know exactly how the crisis is going to break down and where it's going to hit first and how it's going to hit, having these, maybe even a small aspect of these tools as part of your toolbox can be unbelievably meaningful for yourself and for the people that you care about.
You know, we think about what the technology of the future is going to be and how iPhone 10 is going to come along and just totally revolutionize the industry. But maybe it's not going to be going in that direction. Maybe we're going to be going the other direction. Maybe we're going to be heading backwards into a technology plane that our grandfathers used to use and our great grandfathers used to be very familiar with. It's going to be an interesting world when there's no iPhone 45 to hang our hats on.
Yeah, when the idea of technological progress becomes disassociated from the latest Apple product. And that's something we bring up quite a bit on our show. This highlights another story that I came across on NPR. And the local food movement was so revolutionary. And it was such a small movement, even 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. And the changes that I've seen over the last decade have truly been incredible. And this one article that we'll link to in our show notes really highlights that, where community-supported canning is being talked about now and is actually happening as an extension of community-supported agriculture. So where you would go and purchase a share in community-supported agriculture, and over the summer you'll have access to, you know, beautiful veggies and things from the farm that you're subscribing to. Now in the winter months, your CSA actually gets you preserved veggies, where you can get sauerkrauts and preserved tomatoes and all of these things throughout the year. And so it's really exciting to see this one article that's talking about how community-supported preserves are coming along in the same model as CSAs. And this particular story highlights one specific example of it in Maine.
I'm very excited about this, Justin. I'm looking forward to those preserved pickles, because I definitely love pickles. And in much the same way that people are reusing their produce into pickles and canned tomatoes and jars of fantastic sauerkraut, people are also repurposing their media budget into the extra environmentalist. And we are very, 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 very thankful to all the fantastic donors who have sent their hard-earned reclaimed dollars over to the extra environmentalist radio show and podcast.
And that includes people like Paul in California, who sent us a very generous donation. So we're extremely grateful for that.
Thank you so much to Kevin out in Connecticut for the generous donation. Really appreciate it, Kevin.
And also Dean in Colorado.
We also have a repeat donor of Patrick out in Oregon. Thank you so much, Patrick.
And Patrick writes in, he's been donating to our show for quite a while, and he says, why don't we have a subscription option on our website where people could donate, you know, $3, $5, $10 a month on a regular basis to our show? And that's definitely something that I've been thinking about, but I kind of want us to have something to offer if people are going to subscribe and have a kind of, you know, special subscriber thing that we do. But we're just definitely not at that point quite yet. But if you want to send us donation on a regular basis, we are unbelievably grateful for that. And it helps us do things like on our show today, where we had John Michael Greer for you in HD quality, because we were able to use our listener donations to send a microphone to him so he could actually have it in his location in Maryland, as opposed to talking to him on his rural phone line full of noise.
That's right. John Michael Greer now has a permanent microphone via the extra environmentals, via your fantastic donations that lives in his home. He doesn't really always know how to use it very well, but it's there, and it's there for him to use.
And also thanks to Vincenzo in Pennsylvania for sending in a donation. He said that his brother turned him on to the show, so thanks also to your brother. A lot of those donations were above the $30 mark, and that means we're going to send out t-shirts to those people, as well as t-shirts to the many people who are in waiting for those t-shirts. And I just talked to our t-shirt printer the other day, and according to him, our t-shirt should be done next week. That means we'll have those t-shirts printed and shipped to us hopefully by the end of January, which means that by the middle of February, we should be able to get those out. So sometime in February, you can finally receive that Extra Environmentalist t-shirt that you've been waiting for so long.
If you want to hear more of the Extra Environmentalist, feel free to check out our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com, where you can find a full archive of the Extra Environmentalist episodes for your viewing pleasure, for your listening pleasure, for you to download, because they're all under Creative Commons, for you to download and give out to your friends on CDs, remix them into your fancy dubstep remixes, and post them on your Facebook walls. You can find us on Facebook as well as on Twitter. Find us on Stitcher Radio, and send us email at podcasts@extraenvironmentalist.com.
And you can send us a voicemail by calling +1 919 701 9872, or on Skype at The Extra Environmentalist as our handle. And we'd really love to hear any stories of green wizardry that you'd like to share with us that we could play on an upcoming episode. So that's a little piece of inspiration for you. If you have been waiting for that opportunity to call and you want to call in and tell us about maybe the hoop house that you built for your tomatoes, the way that you've converted a small patch of your lawn to keep a few goats or chickens on, something like that, call in, put that phone up to the goat's mouth and let us hear it chomp down on all the compost that you're feeding it.
Don't let that goat eat the phone. That would be really bad.
Yeah, that would be really sad. And that does it for this episode of The Extra Environmentalist. We've got a pretty exciting production schedule lined up for 2014. So now that we're back from our short break over the winter, you can expect The Extra Environmentalist coming at you several times a month with everything that you'd expect and more.
So feature go to smartphone, find your way out into the hoop house and enjoy the last dregs of winter.
Hey, Seth, Justin, this is Kevin here from Sweden. I just got done listening to episode 69, do it actually for the second time. You know, why I really like your guys' podcast here is if all we do is talk about peak oil, climate change, you know, it's kind of like looking at a road sign. We get bored of looking at all those road signs and we end up just kind of ignoring the road signs. So we need to start to look to solutions and everybody, you know, we want to jump on the bandwagon at first and how can we change other people, but we have to really change ourselves, you know, and that's what I've been doing here the last 10 years now since I've been in Sweden, building up this permaculture center. When I first moved here to Sweden, there was an article in the paper and the king got a letter because one of the kings back 200 years ago wanted to plant a forest of oaks because they were going to need some new battleships maybe in the future. So about 10 years ago the king got a letter that his trees were ready to make his battleships. Unfortunately, I don't think Sweden is really looking forward like they should be, like I would like to see them. We hear, yeah, Sweden's really on the front lines of climate, looking at climate and everything. But I was at some local meetings here and all they're talking about is, well, if we trade in all our cars for hybrid cars, you know, so people still want just same old, even here. Keep up the great work and it's good to hear you guys. We'll hear you next month. Doksha.
We now produce as many manufactured goods in each four-year period as all of mankind produced from the dawn of history until 1945. And yet there are more miserable people on Earth than ever before. Gross national product is the conventional measuring stick of the economist. In the name of gross national product, says Schumacher, modern man will resort to any degree of technological violence and human degradation. McRoby and Schumacher are the champions of low technology. They point out that examples of high technology now lie in ruins across Asia and Africa. Nowhere in these offices will you find the plans for the elephant canning factory that had to close down when they discovered that hardly anybody wanted to eat elephant and fewer still wanted to put them in cans. Nowhere on these shelves will you find the plans for the plastic shoe factory that made 40 people rich and put 5,000 shoemakers out of business. These well-meaning schemes to elevate the third world sprang from the brightest brains of the great industrial nations.
These very, very clever people are a trial, and I tend to be impatient with them, which doesn't help. I accuse many of my fellow economists as rearranging with great acumen, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I wish they would at least do something with their hands to get a real feel of things again. If they come and turn real life situations into mathematics, all the life is taken out of it. That I find a great trial. Too many of our academics have got stuck with a concept. The Buddhists say Buddhism is a finger pointing at the moon. For goodness sakes, study the moon, not the finger.
Live coverage of the 2026 Winter Olympic Games. Yeah! live from the United Arab Emirates, hosted in Dubai.
Hello and welcome to the Winter Olympics of 2026. I'm Wright Mioff, joined by my co-host Robert Thruster, and we're bringing you the Winter Olympics like you've never seen them before. Coming to you out of the steamy desert of Dubai, the Winter Olympics in the most energy-inefficient way you've ever seen them before. Robert, let's go through some of the events.
Oh man, Wright, you just have no idea how excited I am to be here. This is an absolutely incredible opportunity to be at the 2026 Winter Olympics here in Dubai, held mostly inside the giant mall in Dubai. This is the closest the Winter Olympics have ever been held to the equator, mainly because over the last 10 years or so, the world has been experiencing such energy austerity that everybody thought the best way to lift the spirits of the world was to blow a tremendous amount of energy into this event. It's incredible. The whole thing is powered by these giant LNG, liquid natural gas, export terminals, where the refrigeration pumps in to the Dubai Mall into the abandoned buildings and powers this amazing display of energy waste. When the bubble burst in Dubai, everybody thought about changing the name from Dubai to Ducell. But now it's time to buy again because we're here for the Winter Olympics. Now, before we get back to you, Wright, I wanted to give a shout out to the official winter drink of the Olympics, named after the leadership here in Dubai, the milkshake Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. It's so exciting. The official milkshake leader of the Olympics. How excited are you to be here, Wright?
My goodness, Robert, this is fan-freaking-tastic. I know people from around the world are tuning in right now on their high-definition 20,000-inch TVs to see what's happening here, right now, right here, right now.
Oh man, right, everybody's watching these events on their iPad 15 super-powered retina displays. They're seeing all the ships out in the harbor, how they're just burning massive amounts of shale oil, liquid natural gas, in order to power the amazing amounts of mind-blowing air conditioning that's flowing into all of the Olympic venues here. Let's run down some of these events.
You got it, Robert. Let's start with the first one here. We've got a ski jump going on inside the mall, and we're going to be bobsledding between the buildings. This is a very exciting time for us here. We are closing off a portion of the city, super cooling the city, and making it perfect for a bobsled and ski jump event inside the mall. It's going to be fantastic.
We're inside the giant mall here in Dubai, profiling our first event. And as far as other Middle Eastern nations go, everybody's expecting Syria to bomb. Let's go inside to our first venue to jump me off, our ski jump expert.
Yeah, Robert, thanks. We have the event all set up inside this empty mall here. We have our competitors lining up on the top of the escalator. The escalator has been extended over 300 feet in the air to give the competitors the leading edge of the jump. You can land in a shoe store, you make your way all the way to the food court, where if you find it a food court, that's usually a silver medal. But if you're going all the way, Robert, you end yourself in a Victoria's Secrets or a H.H. Gregg, you're never going to know what hits you. It's going to be gold medals all the way down.
Thanks for that jump. That's really incredible. As we continue on with our coverage of this incredibly stupid event, I mean the stupidest event that has ever happened, we're going to touch on some of the intricate details of how all of this energy is being wasted to have this event. Now, let's talk about one of your favorite events, right? The Diathlon. Tell me about the Diathlon.
Absolutely, Robert. Absolutely. The Diathlon, one of my favorite events as well, has people running around usually on skis, you know, shooting targets and stuff. This year they've revamped it a little bit. This time they're going to be, instead of shooting targets, we're going to be shooting whales. And this is going to be providing the fuel to maintain the cold temperature for the building. And the trick here, Robert, is if they fail to shoot the whales, then the whole game starts thawing out and everybody has to go home. So these people are keeping the whole place going by shooting these whales. And they have to be really good at shooting because whales are tricky animals to shoot.
Sounds to me like we're going to have a whale of a time here, no matter what.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is one of those things you're not going to want to miss.
Now, we could go over and cover the reconfigured skating, where they have all these abandoned barges from the shipping industry, global shipping industry, reconfigured to host all of the skaters. Or we could talk about the curling on the desalinated part of the ocean that's been frozen. But instead, we're going to wrap up our intro coverage because you're going to get to those events throughout the weeks of the Olympics. So, to close out our intro coverage, we're going to the Olympic torch lighting. We're lighting a giant pile of worthless paper currency.
That's absolutely right, Robert. We have followed the torch burning worthless currency around the world. We've seen dollars being burned in the United States. We've seen Canadian dollars being burned in Canada. We followed down to pesos in Mexico, all the way across to kroners in
in Denmark and in Scandinavia.
This year's Olympic torch is just a giant pile of all the world's worthless currencies.
That's right. And we're going to see it all go up in flame. I see right now that it's being covered in flammable oil. It's getting ready to be lit by our famous... There's a large dump truck backing up, dumping some more currency on here. And here comes the flame now, carried by our very own recently deceased Ben Bernanke's ghost, coming all the way across the pond here to light the torch. This is a fantastic event, Robert. You know, it's choking me up a little bit. And here it goes now, folks. He's running. He's about to take the leap, leaping into the flame of currency right now, and it's all going up. It's so beautiful.
Actually, the flames are so intense, they've actually caught some of the crowd on fire.
And that closes out our initial coverage of the opening ceremonies of the 2026 Winter Olympics in Dubai. When we return, we'll be inside the skeleton of giant abandoned skyscrapers for the skeleton event.
Or we could cut to the half pipeline snowboarding.
You have been listening to The Extra Environmentalist. You can find our extensive audio archive of podcasts, radio broadcasts, blog articles, videos, and much more at www.extraenvironmentalist.com. We're also on Facebook if you search for Extra Environmentalist, and Twitter at @xenvironmental. We welcome all voicemails and feedback through our online contact information. You can find on our website, but also you can shoot us an email directly at podcast@extraenvironmentalist.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on our next episode.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the UBC Vancouver campus on unceded Coast Salish, Musqueam Island. And you are listening to the sound of a horse chewing hay. It says on this video, sound of horses chewing hay. Nay. To use the horse vernacular, nay. It is a singular horse chewing hay. And you can find this video on YouTube. Malen von Wischke. Description says, relaxing moments of the day. The sound of horses chewing hay. With joy, I can sit here for hours, close by dreamy eyes. Satisfaction with no price. Today's show is going to be about the conceptualization of Western frontiers, cowboy culture. And I'm going to fix that rather loosely to a playlist that covers... I don't know, science fiction, planetary objects. It'd be a nice range of things. But first off, Freaky Waves are playing a show tonight at the Biltmore with Mesa Luna and one other band that is escaping me right now. And, you know, just shout out to that. Freaky Waves, absolutely fantastic band. Let's start off by listening to Dig a Hole. And pretty much the first track that came off of that album. They released last year, Bonnie's State of Mind. Freak Heat Waves, of course, post-punk band from Victoria, BC. Are they Western in a sense? Cowboys? They represent the cowboy culture. The video has stopped, by the way. There's no error. It's just the video has run its course. So let's jump into it. See ya.